Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
And welcome to Defrag. It's been a heck of a morning already. We've already had a violent discussion about mice.
It's been the hardware battle.
It has. And it's... Wait until... we'll save it till the end of the show. But let's get started. Oh, and we've been off for a little bit. You were sick.
I'm still sick.
Yeah, so welcome. You're welcome. Don't say I didn't give you anything for Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Right. Well, maybe I can mutate it and give it back.
Nice. All right. Yeah. All right. First question from Alexi says, I want to ask you how to help me solve the problem with my HP ML350G5. I suspect server RAID controller. I already did everything written in KB969550. It didn't help. Blue screen of death happens shortly after user login. Before the issue, I've changed a faulty drive in RAID 1 pair. Maybe there's a registry corruption. Server works fine in safe mode.
So what's actually interesting is that if it works in safe mode, this is hardware RAID. I'm assuming, also don't have a ton of details, that it's the OS is on the actual RAID set. It's highly unlikely for it to be a registry corruption. It's likely another driver that's loaded after RAID, because if you can boot up into safe mode, it means the RAID is working well enough to actually boot the OS.
Yeah.
So when you have the RAID on the system, it's kind of all or nothing-ish, right? It's if RAID is working, you can boot the OS. When you can boot the OS, it's not the RAID.
Yeah.
So
I'm laughing because I had another problem with my RAID at home this weekend, and I know you warned me against it, but yeah.
I keep backing up. Did your system crap out?
No, I just had to reset another drive again.
Oh, yes. At least you're keeping up on the errors.
Yeah.
You know, at least that's something.
Well, every time I see it, it stops my heart. So.
Right. Yeah, so it's like, $50, $60 every time replacing a drive? Or do you have the 3-terabyte drive? So
no, I'm using 2-terabyte.
2 terabytes?
4 2-terabytes, RAID 0.
Right. RAID 0.
So the other thing Alexi says is... Don't ignore this message. Must be up and running ASAP. This might not be your best bet for ASAP tech support.
Right.
We try to get back to you as quick as we can, but
we're not an official support. Yeah. Like, we have no SLA.
Yeah.
And especially if we're not, you know, on premises or have access to the server or any debugging.
So if you're looking for enterprise support, I don't know if Defrag is the best bet, but we'll try to help.
Right. You know, if you've had drive corruption, if your pair might actually be bad, and you could have a driver failing to load correctly, and its settings may be off because you're hitting a bug check. But without actually seeing the memory dump, can't really help.
Yeah.
I would honestly say, you know, rebuild the system. You know, this is an enterprise class server.
Yeah.
There has to be backups for it, and it's actually going to take less time usually to restore the system onto a fresh RAID set that has been, you know, properly provisioned.
Mm-hmm.
If one drive is gone on a RAID pair, because generally speaking, when people set up RAIDs, it's, you know, they buy the same drives at the same time.
Yeah.
They're very, very similar. And if one drive fails, if they're bought from the same lot, I wouldn't say it's a high likelihood, but the likelihood is there that the other drives could be failing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that you really want to look after. The moment that you have a drive fail from, and if you have drives from the same lot, to go look at those, make sure that you do have a good solid backup. Make your spares ready. And I'd suggest getting them of the same type, but from a completely separate lot. And if you can actually do that when you're ordering the drives, you know, you get the same type, the same capacity, the same daughter card on the drive itself.
Yeah.
But make sure that they're different lots. So you decrease the likelihood of more than one drive failing at the same time. But in this particular case, you know, we would need a ton more information in order to help. But, you know, the backup and restore, or at least the restore from backups, is going to be your best bet. Worst case scenario, you got to clean install the server.
Yeah.
And server, you know, if it was a domain controller, if it was something that was very, very specific, could be very painful, which is why you want to have backups.
Yeah. Okay. So send us a memory dump.
Yeah.
Is that what we need on this?
Yeah.
And we'll try to help you out there. All right, next question from David. From a previous show, I remember Gove and Larry talking about using SkyDrive to fetch local files from a PC, even if they aren't shared with SkyDrive. Just today, notice on one of the SkyDrive sites, you can use a PC running Windows 8.1 to fetch files that are on another PC, but you can't fetch files that are on a PC running 8.1 even if you install the SkyDrive desktop app on that PC. Is this a temporary change? Will local file access with SkyDrive as a pass-through ever return? Is there an alternative to access files not shared with SkyDrive on machines that are running SkyDrive, say without remoting into the machine, doing copy and paste or drive mounting? Will the desktop app be updated to Windows 8.1, or is the SkyDrive integration being further integrated in 8.1, killing that off?
Can't say about what the future holds for SkyDrive, because yeah. I actually have no information.
We're not on that team.
I literally can't talk about it.
Yeah,
because I don't have a clue. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, in this case, I would just share it with SkyDrive.
Yeah.
And if it's not available. Or it's too large and you don't have the space on SkyDrive, then yeah, remoting into the machine is basically the same thing that you'd be doing with the SkyDrive app anyways.
Yeah.
So I just remote it.
Okay. All right. Next question. I have a Windows 7 with IE 11. I want to use IE 9 instead of 11 due to some reasons. The problem is that if you look in the installed updates section, you'll not see any upgrade to IE 11, IE 10, or IE 9, so there's no way to roll back to a version prior to IE 11. And I try to install IE 9 with no luck. Any suggestions are highly appreciated.
IE is a system update. Mm-hmm. It updates a whole bunch of various components. And for various reasons, you can't go back. And no, you can't install an older version of IE on the system. However, we'd actually want to know what those reasons are of why you're looking to get IE 9 back on the system, because that one is really pretty old.
Yeah.
We came out with IE 10 relatively quickly after IE 9, and that one has been more of the standard mm-hmm. for a long time, is having IE 10. And IE 11 has just been pushed out, I believe, in the past few weeks. I noticed one of my machines got IE 11. But it'd be interesting to see why you would not be able to use some of the developer tools, for example, to turn off or turn on, I should say, some compatibility modes for various sites. But we need to see what those issues are. But you can't go back to IE9. What you can do, depending if you're in an enterprise infrastructure, you need it for work-related sites.
Yeah.
What you could always do is set up remote apps to a machine that's running IE9, and then you can have a remote app that is IE9 to browse to the sites that you require.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Okay. So you could be on a essentially any OS.
Yeah.
That has remote apps capability. And then if you desperately needed to use IE9 because the site can't be changed, can't be fixed, none of the compatibility view settings make it work, that would be your best option.
Okay, cool. From Robert, just want to let you guys know I watch a lot of podcasts, and your two shows are the best, and I look forward to watching them. Thank you. We love you, too. Update, I had a lot of issues with Bluetooth and Wi-Fi on a few PCs. The latest push from Microsoft fixed them all, and a few... I use the generic Microsoft drivers. Also, I've been researching storage spaces and decided not to go with the NAS. Unless I purchase a certified Microsoft hardware to get it a little flaky. Moving on from computer server to another, I had mixed results. Could you guys revisit the storage spaces and talk about the pluses and minuses?
So storage spaces, pluses. You can use any drive that you got lying around.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people use, drives in older enclosures, older drives, slow drives.
Yeah.
Risk with that, of course, is that they're older, slower.
They're all different.
They're all different. Their controllers might not be perfectly in spec. That's kind of the problem when you start mixing a lot of older hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're using, state-of-the-art hardware, all the same, then you should actually have a much better result with storage space, because you get consistency, and there's definitely added value in consistency.
Yeah.
Some of the minuses are, some people have noticed perf problems,
mm-hmm.
But again, it really depends on the hardware that you're using both on the computer side as well as the peripheral side. Because, I mean, USB, or if you're connecting them via USB, is, you know, relatively CPU intensive. You know, it's a little bit different than, say, FireWire or SATA.
It's not the fastest way either.
It's not the fastest. There's overhead. Mm-hmm. And as you add more drives, there's more and more overhead. My personal opinion is storage spaces are good if you are low scale, right? If you want to add a couple of extra drives, you know, you have some 500s kicking around, you need to get a little bit more space.
Yeah.
I think that's good. If you're trying to use it in a server-style environment, mm-hmm. Unless you're using server storage spaces, you know, if, when I say server in my environment, I mean my type of environment, where at home I have, you know, essentially a desktop machine, a very beefy desktop machine that acts like a server.
Yeah.
But in that environment, I actually use RAID, mm-hmm. you know, and with server class drives.
Yeah.
Because it's on 24/7. I require the reliability. The cards that I use are enterprise class cards, because I want the extra performance. I want all of the extra goodness that that will provide.
Yeah.
Without the overhead.
And stability.
And stability, without the overhead of using USB.
Yeah.
I don't want to deal with flaky cables, I don't want to deal with flaky controllers, don't want to deal with flaky firmwares, yada yada.
Mm-hmm.
So I like going with consistency and a little bit higher quality, which is one of my minuses towards storage spaces. And I find setting up RAID actually to be a lot simpler because you know, you set up once, you set up in the BIOS level RAID, and it's basically invisible to Windows. You know, there's no additional software, there's no additional services or anything like that. It's just the driver.
Mm-hmm.
It's simplified. It's kind of tried and true.
Yeah.
And again, it's not that I'm opposed to storage spaces at all. It definitely has its place.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what I use.
What about NAS?
I'm not a great fan of NAS. I find them to be relatively slow.
Yeah.
With a server-based system, I can do things like channel bonding. You can get a reasonably priced switch that will nick bond your gigabit taps and make it seem like a 2 or 3 gigabit per second connection.
Mm-hmm.
NASs don't always have that. Generally, NASs run a flavor of Unix or Linux on it.
Yeah,
it just adds that another layer of complexity to your system.
Yeah,
I mean, there's plenty of good NAS boxes out there,
and I have nothing against a NAS box either. It just when I go to do it, there's a few that I trust. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how they work inside and out, and so I'm left less comfortable with those than I would be just building my own system.
Right.
Because I know how that works. I know how to administer it, and I can handle that. So I'm just not as comfortable with a NAS box. And when I look at the ones that I would trust or get, they're so expensive. I'm like, I could just build my own system.
Exactly.
And, you know, it costs less, and mm-hmm. I know how to administer it, so I'm just more comfortable with that. So that's all the pluses and minuses for me.
Yeah, and the thing with, you know, using a computer or a Windows-based machine is that it can be multi-purpose.
Yeah.
Right? And I know on my system, you know, I have it for encoding. I have it for as a remote app server, oddly enough, mm-hmm. for different applications where, you know, my systems, I tend to consider them more throwaway. Like, if they go down, I don't really care. I'll just throw in another one.
Yeah.
My important apps that I care about are through remote apps where I can use the horsepower of the server. That's the thing that I care about.
Yeah.
Like this, if I lose it, well, A, I'd be very annoyed, but it's not like I'm losing any critical data.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. I'm manually backing up data off of a hard drive that has XP installed on it because I suspect the drive is failing. I want to copy the files, but I don't want to change the owner or any permissions on the original drive to be able to do so. Is there any way to do this?
NT backup. You need an actual backup application. XP has it.
Yeah.
You know, just use that.
Okay.
If you're backing up to a store to a different OS, you may want to use a third-party backup software that will work on a later OS. Because, I mean, if you're just backing up data,
mm-hmm.
fundamentally, it it doesn't matter that you're changing the ownership.
Yeah.
You know, you can just copy the files off, copy them back when you've rebuilt the system, preferably with, you know, Win 8.1 on it, mm-hmm. and it'll just inherit the ownership of the directory that it's been copied into. You're not going to lose anything by doing that. If you are going back and rebuilding an XP box and restoring back, don't. Why would you rebuild an XP box?
Okay.
But frankly, if for whatever reason, like if they're EFS, they're encrypted files, mm-hmm. Make sure that you back up the encryption key as well. But other than that, I wouldn't necessarily worry about it. But if you are concerned, use NT-backup or something that actually uses real backup and restore that preserves the ownership and security.
Cool. All right, next question. I have a Windows 7 desktop with 5 SATA drives. I'd like to make 4 of the drives into a RAID 5, but leave 1, the OS drive, as is. I've found these options, but they don't work for me. Set up a software RAID through Windows via disk management. This doesn't work for me because I need another Linux machine to be able to access the RAID array. I've read that the software RAID is not recognized by other OSs. And the second one is set up a RAID using PCIe RAID card. This doesn't work for me because my desktop currently has no PCIe slot available. When I look through BIOS, I see RAID setup, but I think that's for the whole system, all 5 drives. Anyway, I could set up a RAID using... Oh, could I only set up a RAID using only some of the drives?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, you should be able to. And when your system starts up, like at least with mine, there's an option, you know, hit Control-I right now to go into the RAID section and set that up. And when you do that, you should be able to make your RAID volume there, and you should be able to select whatever drives you want.
Yeah, what you may want to do is go to a slightly different screen that is just about your drives. Mm-hmm. You'll usually get toggles for 2 different types, SATA and RAID. Mm-hmm. If they're all set up as RAID, that's why it would automatically default to having them all 5 set up.
Yeah.
But what you want to do is change. If it is in fact already set up as RAID, mm-hmm. all 5 drives, you can't just switch one back.
Yeah.
You'll break the RAID and your system won't boot.
Yeah.
So before you do any of this, back up your system, prepare for it to be completely wiped out because you're going to be changing a RAID configuration. Change one drive, and don't really care which one it is, because if the whole system is set up on RAID, you're breaking it anyways.
Yeah.
Set up one drive as your OS drive, and then you can set the other 4 as RAID. And I suggest, you know, this is just a data volume, set up as RAID 5 and be done mm-hmm. with it. You know, you get some redundancy with it, and you can do RAID 5 with 4 drives, no problem.
Okay, cool. All right, next question. I have a DLNA-enabled Samsung Blu-ray player. It's connected to my home network, and I'm able to stream media from a Windows 7 computer to the TV via the player. However, I'd like to use this player as a Blu-ray drive to my PC. Is this possible?
No.
No. All right. Trying to think of some weird way to do it, and there's not a good way because it's not a data drive. You'd have to pass through the image, which is not going to be a great experience. So there's that. Next question.
I mean, or not without breaking the Blu-ray system. I mean.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, if you have HDMI out, like, you bring it in through a... Yeah, it's not a... You wouldn't... No, don't do it. Blu-ray drive's cheap. Go buy a Blu-ray drive.
Right.
Stick it in your computer. It's, what, $30 or something. Don't worry about it.
Right.
All right. Scenario goes like this. A computer is infected with a ransomware and you can't do anything else, and all you have is a command prompt window. Now, how do you set desktop's EXE as an auto run program so that you'll be able to trigger it to use a keyboard combination to launch a virtual desktop where you can do troubleshooting?
I wouldn't do any of that.
You'd pay the ransomware? What would you do?
Oh, God, no.
No, I'm just kidding.
You have to fix that system offline. You can use the downloadable Microsoft Safety Scanner. But you cannot trust that system right now.
Yeah.
Right. It is absolutely fundamentally compromised.
Yeah.
So you have to boot up into another OS that will inspect that thing offline. Now, manually, I'd be looking at, you know, run keys, services, drivers.
Yeah.
What is there that shouldn't be there? Mm-hmm. Can the system boot up in safe mode? I'm assuming not.
Yeah.
But you have to attack the system from offline. If I encountered a system like that, I wouldn't even bother trying to clean it. I'd boot up into it offline, I'd grab the data files, wipe and load.
Yeah. Because it's been compromised to the point that you should just start over.
You will never be 100% certain that there is not something else lurking there. The other aspect of that is consider how the ransomware got on the system in the first place.
Yeah.
Was it from a downloaded program, right? What did the user do? Because the user did something in order to get this ransomware, assuming that they're not running XP, which, of course, if they were, then yeah, all bets are off.
Yeah.
If they did something, you need to go and inspect their files because their files could be infected, right? Like, what you need some sort of track back, of working back of when the problem occurred. You need to inspect it and figure out, okay, what did they do that day, right? Like, figure out, did they download any files? Did they execute? Did they install something? You know, what were they surfing? But you kind of have to look at it as this is a diseased person, right? Think of it from the house metaphor, right? Figure out what it was that introduced this. You got to work backwards.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily advocate killing the patient under normal circumstances, but, you know, the computer is dying. Let it not infect others.
Yeah, yeah. All right, next question. I love to pin the Process Explorer from SysInternals to my taskbar. However, procexp.exe is a 32-bit application. It launches a 64-bit procexp64.exe on a x64 system. However, when I pin it to the taskbar and try to launch the application later, I have the message which claims procexp64.exe cannot be found because physically on the hard drive I have only procexp.exe. How can I solve this problem?
What he's trying to do is pin the already running application, which is procx64. Don't even try to pin that. Pin the XE directly, the one that you downloaded.
Okay.
Pin to taskbar. That's it. So you pin the 32-bit
one. Don't overthink it.
Don't overthink it, yeah. Just pin the 32-bit one, launch it, it'll launch the 64-bit one, you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really all you got to do.
All right, next question. I have no clue why it restarts, but it is not due to Windows Update. It always happens during 3 to 4 a.m. The OS is Win 7 64-bit. That's
event
all the
logs.
Information we have.
Event logs.
Yeah, so look at your event logs. That should tell you what's going on there.
I'd like to figure out why he thinks that it isn't Windows Update.
Yeah.
Because 3 to 4 a.m., that's the maintenance hour.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that should be Windows Update.
And that's a good time to restart. So, yeah. It doesn't seem like it would be anything other than Windows Update, but...
It shouldn't be. However, there are other applications that could take advantage of the maintenance
hour.
Sure,
yeah, right? And like anyone else could...
Could be rebooting.
Could be doing it, too. So we need to look at the event logs, but yeah, send those and we'll take a look. But yeah, but don't just rule out Windows Update until we know more information.
Right.
All right, next question. I view a lot of pictures for QA duties. Is there any way to always make Windows 7 display extra large icons when browsing through folders in Windows Explorer? Right now, every time I change folders, I need to zoom in to extra large icons every time.
You bet. Now, I don't have pictures on this system, but what you can do is, so go to the view, and I've marked it as extra large icons. You go to options, and you go to view, and you say apply this view to all folders.
Mm-hmm.
You choose that. Now, when you say folders of this type, what you want to do is go into properties. When you're in a picture, click customize, and then choose optimize this folder for pictures. And then what it'll do is, if you do that for the folders that you're looking at that have pictures in it, you ensure that they're optimized for pictures. When you say reset it or apply a particular view, it means every picture folder now will be an extra large icon mode.
Okay.
And that's nice and simple.
Cool. All right. Pick of the week time. Couple of picks of the week, and I know you're going to love this
first.
One. Yeah, okay. So my first one is a post from Gavin Gear on the Extreme Windows blog talking about the 50-inch 4K TV. The brand name, I don't know how to say this. Was it Seiki?
Sure.
All right, fine. Seiki. 50-inch 4K TV makes a great PC display for about $1,000, and it was on sale at Amazon for $769.
It's a good price.
So $769 for a 4K display, a 50-inch 4K display, is a heck of a good deal.
Hell, for a 50-inch...
Yeah, for any 50-inch, it's a good deal. But 4K...
That's actually pretty sweet.
I mean, when we were looking at 4K at CES last year, which is less than a year ago, I mean, when I was over talking to Gavin about 4K displays. He was working on some Red cameras, and he needed some 4K displays. And we had to go, like, borrow some from the Xbox team, and they were, like, $10,000 displays.
Right.
And it didn't seem like any time in the near future you're going to be able to get a 4K display for an affordable price. So this is pretty interesting. So $769 for the 50-inch. The 39-inch that they have also got marked down too. I think it's under, you know, $500 now. So the 39-inch is the one that I would go with.
That, and I would go with that one over the 50-inch. I would even prefer something smaller than the 39-inch, say 25 to 30 inches would be what I would personally go for, because a 4K display at...
Here he
50
goes.
Inches.
Here he goes with his calculator.
So I care about DPI.
Yeah, let's talk about your calculator here and why you break that out when we start talking about displays.
So a 4K display is 3840 by 2160.
Yeah.
Okay. 3840 by 2160 at 50 inches, okay, is 88. DPI.
Okay.
That's less than a 96 DPI regular old LCD that you could have lying around.
All right.
Now at 39, at 39 inches, 112. That's barely above 96. That's still, in terms of scaling high DPI mode with Windows, you're still looking at about 100% here.
Yeah.
Which is why I'd want to take it down to at least 30 inches. That's at 140. That means I could scale at 150 and make things still look really, really nice.
Yeah.
Now, the best possible reason for a 39 or a 50 inch of this 4K display is if you desperately need real estate. Like, are you working with movies, photo editing,
and you have 20 tabs open?
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, that is totally what you'd want to be doing, because, you know, at 50 inches in terms of, you know, using it as a computer monitor.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would still be, you know, as if you took multiple smaller 100% scaling displays, stacked them on each other, right?
Yeah.
So it'd be totally readable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a much smaller monitor with a higher DPI, you'd have scaling involved in order to make it readable. Otherwise, things would be much, much too tiny.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a 50-inch display with this is still less than 96 DPI, so things are still going to look relatively large.
Haters going to hate.
I don't hate it. I really don't hate it. I just wish that they had a smaller version, a more manageable version.
Well,
that
I wish there was better stuff
that was so
in
crisp.
The world, too.
It'd be much, much crisper.
But this is what we have. We,
sure.
We have to work with what we got.
This is a 4K TV.
Yeah.
Right? Like, let's be clear. It's a TV.
And
it's not a computer monitor.
It's 30 hertz, too, when you're gaming at 4K, too. So let's get that out there, too. If you're going to game, you're going to get, you know, 30 frames per second on it at 4K, which my thing is, I'm all right with that. You know, when I was flying Flight Sim X before and had all the graphics turned all the way up, which at 4K, I imagine if I had all the graphics turned all the way up on my machine, I'd be lucky to be getting 30 frames a second anyway, so I think that'd be okay. And plus, with me, I think I would want to do three of these 39-inch displays at 4K. Which, you know, what, 12,000 pixels wide and 2,200 tall, that's asking a lot of my computer.
It is.
So I think, you know, 30 frames a second wouldn't be the end of the world anyway.
Sure.
I could live with that.
Right, but again, remember, it's a TV.
It is a TV, yeah.
So simply using it as a computer monitor, I think that once we start seeing computer monitors that are of the same ilk, with a higher DPI or PPI, that, you know, you'll be able to buy me into that.
Yeah, and they will be out there this year at CES. I'm already seeing emails about that, and that's one of the things Gavin is going to focus on when we go to CES this year. Is he's going to watch all the 4K monitors, and we'll have more information about that then. But as far as this one, I would do it. I wouldn't do the 50-inch. I've seen this 50-inch display on Gavin's desktop, and it looks nice. There's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that. But for me, I think the real sweet spot in using a big monitor on your desk is 40 inches. Mm-hmm. So anything bigger than 40, and it's far enough out of your periphery when you're looking forward,
sure.
that it just seems too big to work with.
Right.
I have 3 42-inch monitors on my desk at home. Mm-hmm. I love it, especially for gaming. And they're all running 1080p. Mm-hmm. Which is fine for me. And again, I mean, I don't have, you know, super high resolution retina display going on with those, but it's fine for me. It works perfectly. And I think for the 39-inch 4K displays, 3 of those would be sweet. I think I could live with that.
Mm-hmm.
Even with the 30 frames per second.
Okay.
So, all right. But anyway, check out Gavin's post. We'll have more at CES, and stay tuned. Next pick of the week is Photosynth. So I did this video with David Getty when they announced Photosynth 2. And I just want to talk about some of these collections that I've made. And if you use the back arrow and go back, you can see that these are some of the Photosynths that I made. When I found out that Photosynth 2 was coming, I went back through some of my really old collections of Photosynths that I made. I collect images from the Apollo moon landings. And so I have thousands and thousands of these images. So when I got access to Photosynth 2, I just started dropping them all in there. Yeah, you like that, huh? It's a kid's Lego sets.
It was the one that... It stands out after you did this. So I was like, huh.
Old black and white moon pictures. Oh, wait a minute.
Right, it's like playing
Quidditch.
The Sesame Street game. One of these things is not like the other.
Yeah. So I dumped all these images into Photosynth. Some of the moon ones are really cool. Go in there and check them out. This, you haven't seen the moon like this. I mean, some of these images, like here, let me go back to this one, which I'm sure like everyone has seen the Earth coming up over the horizon of the moon images. Mm. And the still images are kind of cool. But when you see them in series on with Photosynth 2, it's kind of cool. You just haven't seen them like that before.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool to just go back through some of the different ones. I also started looking at high resolution imagery of the sun, and so this is one from SOHO. This is the bronze. I think it's 193 images. And they're, you know, really high resolution. You can zoom in with touch and scroll back and forth. So, it's kind of cool. Play around with it. I'm really looking forward to some of the stuff that people are going to do with these. The new Photosynth 2 allows you to make collections of Photosynths that where you navigate through them. And you mm-hmm. can make different types. You can circle around something. You can circle outside. So it's like looking in at something, looking out at something, which is like a panorama. You can do a walkthrough.
Like a virtual tour?
Yeah, like a real estate kind of thing. And you can do a wall, which is like going down a wall looking at something.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to this. Some of the interesting things I'd like to see is, you know, how are news operations, how would they use some of these? So I was looking for some old news photographs that I used to have collections of. And feed them through there and see what that looks like. I'm sure that for police looking at evidence, I mean, I can think of a million different things that it would be really interesting for. But another one that would be cool is, you know how in the Olympics when they're following the long jump person mm-hmm. and they have a camera that goes down and follows them jumping, I want to see one of those where they pull the frames out of the HD video like every 10 frames mm-hmm. and build a Photosynth wall out of those, because you should be able to scrub forward and back and see the guy like from the time he takes off until he lands, and just so many different things I want to try out with this. I've been trying everything. I just got a Ricoh camera that does 360 degree photos mm-hmm. and I want to shoot a whole bunch of those. And you, when you zoom all the way out, there's like a lot of parallax as things warp as you move forward. And I want to see, how's Photosynth handle that?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, play around with it. Try to break Photosynth, doing weird things. Send me your results. Let me see what you're doing. And, can't wait to see what you make.
Okay.
And then what's your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is, a little bit more, slightly more esoteric. Comcast has relatively recently rolled out dual stack IPv6 for all of Washington, as well as other states, Arizona. And right now, they're the largest ISP in the world with their IPv6 rollouts.
All right.
Which is actually really cool. And for those of you in Washington or Arizona or any of the other places where they've rolled out their dual stack IPv6, what you want to do is go check your router, mm-hmm. Contact Comcast, and upgrade to their latest one. It should be free of charge just to throw in your old DOCSIS router if you don't have a DOCSIS 3.0 router, and get that, as well as my personal favorite for home-based routers is the Asus RT N66U, the Dark Knight. It's their name, not mine.
Yeah, all right.
I really, really enjoy this router.
Yeah.
However, their latest firmware has caused me some issues. It's where they've updated to the Broadcom SDK version 5 or 6 on their 5 gigahertz band. I've had some massive issues with that one. I've had to roll back to their latest release just prior to their major release, mm-hmm. That happened in September, October of this year. But this has native IPv6 capabilities. So what happens when you pair this router to your DOCSIS 3 router with IPv6 dual stack is that it will set up DHCP for IPv6 in your home. And that means what you'll see is, for example, here on this system, if you take a look at it, I have native IPv6 connectivity to the internet and IPv4 connectivity to the internet. A lot of systems will have this as being none.
Yeah.
Or not connected.
Yeah. And so what is the benefit the average person would see out of having IPv6?
For the average person, not a lot. What it does is it gives your machine a publicly addressable IP address from anywhere in the world, right? Like, you're not having to go through NAT anymore, which is what you'd have to do normally in your house with an IPv4 address. But it just opens up whole new capabilities of being able to access your machine without having to worry about NAT. One of the advantages is remote assistance that is built into Windows. When you run remote assistance, MSRA, and you invite someone to help you, if you're on, I believe, Vista and higher, there's this Easy Connect option. If you choose that and you're on IPv6, and Teredo is the version of IPv6 translation that is built into the OS, it can be somewhat finicky depending on your ISP, its route to the person that's trying to help you. I've not had this particular problem when I'm on native IPv6.
Yeah.
Use Easy Connect, and anybody that you give the password to will be able to come and help you. I actually would like to try this out for anybody out there that is using IPv6 native and not Teredo. Mm-hmm. If you're actually having problems, I'd like to try and help you using Easy Connect.
Cool.
It's a misunderstood, highly underutilized tool in Windows to help people. It's just like remote desktop, except you're still there. You're still in control until you give the person that's helping you control.
Yeah.
But you can stop it at any time. The tickets are time-bombed. So when you send an invitation as a file or you use Easy Connect, it's time-limited, by default, 6 hours.
Yeah.
That a person can come help you. Afterwards, it doesn't matter if they still have the auto-generated password, they still won't be able to connect to your machine. Mm-hmm. So in terms of true end-user benefit, it's still limited. The number of websites out there that are native IPv6 or dual-stack IPv6 are still relatively few, but as more and more users get dual-stack IPv6 or native IPv6, the number of websites we're hoping to see change to be in true IPv6 mode will increase, and then that will hopefully deprecate IPv4. Now, in all honesty, IPv4 is not going away for a very, 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 very long time.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if it even starts going away in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. I'd be extremely, extremely surprised, because it's just too much infrastructure is built on it. But there's a lot of benefits to IPv6. There's security benefits, performance benefits. At home on my Comcast network, Comcast has a speed test between IPv4 and IPv6. I'm getting about 10% to 15% extra throughput on IPv6.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an inherently better protocol. It's a more modern protocol. IPv4 was built around the 70s with, over time, it's just had additions tacked on to the standard. It was never really built with security performance in mind. It was built for, you know, connecting university labs together over much of it over dial-up,
mm-hmm.
right? So scalability was not one of its fortes. IPv6, however, scalability, massive forte. And in a later show, I want to talk about Internet of Things and go into that and how IPv6 is going to be really, really helpful in that case.
Cool. Awesome. All right. Well, that's the show for this week. If you have questions, write us at defragshow@microsoft.com, and we'll see you next week.
Take care.